Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen, Executive Vice President of the Center for Security Policy, sitting in for my boss, Frank Gaffney, to bring you some Secure Freedom Radio. Now, I want to talk to you about the danger we face that our government and a collection of leftist thought police and jihadist speech suppressors don't want you to hear about. We have a new film titled The Enemy Is Here coming out. The title points out the impossible to ignore fact that Islamists are here in the United States. Now, that's both the violent jihadists, like those who perpetrated San Bernardino, Orlando, the Boston Marathon bombings, and far too many other acts of violence, but also their partners in crime, the civilization jihadists who want to subvert and destroy our country from within. Now, those aren't my words. Those come from the Muslim Brotherhood in America, in a document that was captured in a police raid in Virginia. It was part of a report from these Muslim brothers back to the mothership in Egypt about their progress in the United States. Now, sadly for us, the report said progress was very good. They had started many groups to act as fronts, pushing the idea that Islam is all about peace, and any talk of dangers of Islamic terror was just Islamophobia and hate speech. Well, let me give you a taste of just how real the threat actually is, and how well they've done at hiding it from us. I'm going to play a clip from a speaker at the Muslim American Society's annual conference from last year. Now, this lady works for them. She's a Muslim convert, and she works as a contractor helping bring refugees into this country. What she says will send a chill down your spine.
That we are the community that staged a revolution across the world. If we could do that, why can't we have that revolution in America? You know what you should do. And if we do it, Allah has promised us the same victories that He granted to those who came before us.
There are so many things wrong with this, I hardly know where to start. First off, she felt comfortable saying this to an entire auditorium full of Muslims. The folks President Obama and Hillary Clinton would have us believe are all kind, peaceful souls who we have no reason to scrutinize in any way. Second, the Muslim American Society posted this video on their website. They didn't see anything wrong with what she said. They endorsed it, for God's sakes. She's calling for revolution in America like they had overseas, like the Arab Spring, like when they overthrew Gaddafi, like when the Muslim Brotherhood took over Egypt. These people are our enemies, and she's saying they should be emulated here in the United States. That's horrifying. Third, this happened in Chicago, a month or so before the Trump rally, which was attacked by mobs of protesters, and which, from the John Podesta email dump, we now know was probably paid for by Soros, the Democrats, and Hillary's campaign. They think they can have a revolution in America because their infiltration of our institutions has been so successful. Even worse, there's a growing coalition of the radical left and radical Islam that we call the Red-Green Axis. Now, they own the media, they own academia, and they own the government for all intents and purposes. I have no idea how the grotesquely oppressive Islamists got the left to fly air cover for them. I mean, it makes no sense. It should be anathema to the left, since Islam as they practice it is misogynistic, gay-hating, and even killing, and a totalitarian ideology barely wrapped in the cloak of religiosity. but cover for it they do. And a perfect example of that is this week, the Southern Poverty Law Center released what they call a field guide to anti-Muslim extremists. Cute. A field guide so you can go out and use your binoculars to study them. Well, they name Frank Gaffney, my boss, host of this show, as well as a number of other brave souls who have the guts to stand up against the encroachment of these barbarians. And this year, they even added some Muslim reformers to the list who had the temerity to use their own personal experience with the horrors of life under these Islamic supremacists as a teaching point for the rest of us. Those folks now have been exiled from the community of decent people for pointing out, like Ayan Hirsi Ali, that when she was mutilated as a child, when she was forced into a life of servitude, that that was somehow wrong, that that's not something that all little girls around the world should have to put up with. At some point, the American left used to profess that they were the ones who stood up for freedom. They talk about a war on women. Is there a greater war on women anywhere on this planet than that of a totalitarian ideology that declares that women are property, that they can be married off against their will, that their testimony in court is worth less than that of a man? That's an actual war on women. And somehow the progressive, tolerant, diverse left has decided that those are the good guys, and those of us who stand up and say, wrong, are haters, are anti-Muslim, are Islamophobes. We're the ones standing up for the Muslims who are being oppressed by these totalitarian, patriarchal ideologues. We believe that women should have a right to live their lives, that little girls shouldn't be mutilated, and that gays should not be thrown off of rooftops. But somehow, we're the bad guys? How in the world did we get to there? Let me be clear. Neither Frank Gaffney nor I are anti-Muslims. I believe there are plenty of Muslims who pose no threat and want to just live their lives in peace and harmony. But there are far too many, more than a third worldwide, according to polls from left-wing outfits like Pew International, who believe they're required by Islam to crush the rest of us under an iron sandal and impose their doctrine on us. They must be opposed, they must be called out, and in the end, they must be defeated or they will take us down. That's why our film, The Enemy Is Here, is so important. It shows the success they have had already and should serve as a call to rhetorical and policy arms to oppose and roll it back. Now, don't believe for a second this is going to be easy. This is a long war. This is a clash of civilizations. This is a war for the free world, as Frank says often. And you have to take into account the fact that the left and the Islamists have a plan, and they've been working that plan for a long time. And as we said, they're doing well. Andy McCarthy coined the term willful blindness for his book about trying the blind sheikh who was behind the first attempt to blow up the World Trade Center, and he got him convicted. But he called the government's approach to the problem willful blindness, as in we were stopping ourselves from actually looking at the problem and naming it and doing anything about it. Well, he has since updated that term and now calls it compulsory blindness. Not only have we done it and forced ourselves to ignore the enemy, to call them violent extremists as opposed to Islamic terrorists, we no longer allow the topic to come up without trying to punish people. So you've got people like the Southern Poverty Law Center putting out field guides to anti-Muslim extremists instead of talking about the actual extremists who are killing people and trying to shut down freedom for everyone. And you've got Hillary Clinton aiding and abetting the United Nations in their misguided attempt to punish speech critical of Islam. That cannot be tolerated. We must stand up both for free speech and the freedom of our civilization as a whole. The time to do it is now, because they're not just chipping away at these things. They're cutting our freedoms off at the knees. And unless all of us stand up and shout, "Not here," they will accomplish it. Up next, we're going to talk with Robert Spencer, who somehow made the SPLC's anti-Muslim extremist list, despite being neither anti-Muslim nor an extremist. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio, and we're going to be joined this segment by Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, as well as a weekly columnist for PJ Media and Front Page Magazine, and author of The Truth About Muhammad, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. Now, Robert, I have a feeling that some of the work I just mentioned, this whole telling the truth about Muhammad and being politically incorrect, is what got you into trouble with the Southern Poverty Law Center again. They happen to release this week their field guide to anti-Muslim extremists, which is kind of a cute thing. I guess they're playing that you guys are, you know, kind of gorillas in the midst, or maybe rare exotic birds that left-wing, you know, types could go ahead and watch and take pictures of and then shun from polite society. I would congratulate you on this, because it is a sign that, you know, like taking flak, you're over the target. But it's actually kind of a horrifying thing that these guys get taken seriously, and their attempts to silence speech critical of Islam and other things are as effective as they are. So what's your opinion of their field guide overall?
Well, you're absolutely right, Jim. This is an attempt to stigmatize, demonize, and marginalize any and all effective voices who speak honestly about the nature and magnitude of the jihad threat. And the worst aspect of it is that the mainstream media, which of course we increasingly see from WikiLeaks, is a bought and paid for propaganda arm itself, takes them seriously and presents the Southern Poverty Law Center not as a far left propaganda outfit, which it is, but as some sort of a respectable watchdog on these matters, which it most certainly is not. And the worst aspect of this new list is the name itself, anti-Muslim extremists, because of course extremists is kind of an empty word, but it is the word that the Obama administration uses for jihad terrorists. And so it's saying that we are essentially the same as people like Omar Mateen and Syed Rizwan Farooq and others who are actual killers in the name of Islam. We are, the SPLC is suggesting, the opposite side of that and just as extremist as they are. And so they're equating us with mass murderers.
That's been part of the problem with Obama's entire counter-terror policy, which he calls countering violent extremism, is they use it as much as a deflection to pretend that right-wing extremism of whatever flavor, and there are evil neo-Nazi scumbags and people like that who should be taken down as terrorists. But that's not the same as saying people on the right who are simply speaking the truth about what is a violent, evil ideology should be characterized the same way.
Yes, and this is what's insidious about the SPLC in general, because you do have real groups like the KKK. I mean, the Klan is not really as powerful as the SPLC would have us believe, but it does exist. And there are neo-Nazi groups and so on. And then to take people like Frank Gaffney and David Horowitz and me and others, Ayan Hirsi Ali, who suffered from Islamic supremacism in Somalia and so on, and is under a death threat from Islamic jihadis, and to say that we're the same as those jihadis, it's obviously a propagandistic attempt to make sure that our influence in the mainstream is as limited as possible.
Now, I've been called anti-Muslim by any number of these left-wing tools, and I have, I guess, an advantage in many ways on a lot of them. I can point out that I did years of humanitarian work in Muslim countries
while serving in Army Special Forces. That's something a lot of these people don't understand, is Special Forces' mission includes interacting with the local populace and the rest of it. So I've immunized Muslim kids. I've built them schools. I've dug them wells. You know, I've helped their lives become better. And you want to call me anti-Muslim or other folks anti-Muslim, you have to prove that there's some sort of animus there, as opposed to simply pointing out that the people who are the extremists, the actual jihadists, are hurting more Muslims than they are anyone else.
Yeah, Jim. You know, I'd venture to say that nary a person on this list is genuinely anti-Muslim. To say that we are is as tantamount to saying that people who were fighting the Nazis during World War II are anti-German. The jihadis are a subset of Muslims, and they do use the texts and teachings of Islam to justify violence and supremacism and hatred. These things are obviously verifiable facts, but to point them out is all too often equated by groups like the SPLC with hating all Muslims, as if to identify the motivating ideology of the jihadis is an act of hate in itself. And this, again, is an attempt to stigmatize, demonize, and marginalize those of us who do this.
And that is, in my mind, a very useful differentiating point, to say it's the ones who believe that Islam should be supreme who are our enemies, and who state categorically that they are our enemies and are working to shut us down. So where is the hatred there? That seems to me to be a simple fact of self-preservation.
Well, you know, it's constantly conflated. Two things are constantly put together that are actually quite distinct, and that is the teachings of Islam and any individual Muslim. Now, it's true of Islam as it is of Christianity or Judaism or any other religion, but the teachings of the religion are one thing, and how any individual believer puts those teachings into practice is quite another. And they are not just 100% equivalents. As a matter of fact, you hardly ever see 100% equivalence that the teachings of the religion are one thing and that is exactly what some individual person does. Most Christians don't love their enemies or turn the other cheek. Those things are very hard to do, but that doesn't mean that Jesus didn't say them. And the Quran and Islam teach jihad warfare against unbelievers. That doesn't mean that every Muslim follows out those teachings, but the fact that many Muslims do not, which is a welcome thing, does not mean those teachings don't exist.
Pointing that out alone and saying it's not all Muslims still categorizes you as a hater who should be shunned, as opposed to someone who's pointing out maybe the rest of the Muslims in the world would be better off if the folks who are trying to crush them, who are putting women in potato sacks, who are mutilating little girls, who are doing these things that are fundamentally against freedom, maybe pointing out that fact is an actual act of liberation, not hatred.
Yes, of course. But I think the whole idea of the SPLC list and the whole idea of saying that to speak honestly about how jihadis use the teachings of Islam to justify their actions and to make recruits among peaceful Muslims, that the whole enterprise of saying that all that is in itself hateful and bigoted and so on is part of a larger strategy, that they know that there is a very great premium nowadays or great suspicion of hate speech, bigotry, racism, and so on in the West. Racism, of course, in the United States, that's our national trauma, going back to the days of slavery. And so to identify the resistance to jihad with racism and hatred is a tremendously skillful way to stigmatize it so that decent people think, oh, no, there's something wrong with resisting terrorism. It's racist. And we saw that work out quite vividly and horrifyingly, in a sense, at Fort Dix, when there was a plot to shoot as many American soldiers as possible inside Fort Dix. And it was foiled when the jihadis went to a video store and asked this young kid who was working there to transfer their VHS tapes of jihad videos to DVD. When he saw all the blood and gore on them, he was horrified. And he thought, these people are dangerous, there's something up. And he went to his manager and said, I'm seeing very disturbing things on these videos. Should I go to the police or would that be racist? And the fact that he even hesitated for a second, that he suspected that it might be racist to turn in people who were obviously up to no good, it shows how insidious this enterprise is and how effective it's been over the years. That a kid growing up in the United States in the last 10 years just sort of reflexively assumes that to stand up to jihad terror, to oppose it, to try to stop it, something wrong with that. That's a racist thing to do.
Well, Robert, you do not succumb to that censorship and that politically correct speech suppression. And thank you for that. Thank you so much for joining us. Up next, we're going to be talking with Dr. Bruce Bechtol.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back and talking this segment with Dr. Bruce Bechtol, who is an associate professor of political science at Angelo State University and a former intelligence officer at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and also someone who spends a lot of time watching what's going on in the hermit kingdom of North Korea. Now, Bruce, that's an area I'm very familiar with. I was in 1st Special Forces Group. Our area of operations was the Pacific Rim, and my battalion specific was the Koreas and what's going on. They've been a mess for a long time, and yet they still always seem able to create havoc and trouble by picking the most dangerous things to be involved in, such as nuclear weapons and their proliferation, and using that to vastly, asymmetrically increase their overall clout in the world. They seem to be deeply involved in that again with more missile testing, et cetera. What are they up to?
Thank you for introducing me. And secondly, are you talking about the recent test that there's argument now over whether it was a Musudan IRBM or a KN-08 ICBM?
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because one of those might be capable of making it to the United States if that's what they were testing, correct?
Absolutely. Both the commanding general of USFK about a year and a half ago and the director of NORAD, the commanding general of NORAD, and DCI, the director of the national director of intelligence, the title that he's called now, have all said that the KN-08 is capable of both carrying a nuclear warhead and, once operational, of reaching the United States. So if this is the KN-08 that was being tested, it certainly is a game changer as opposed to the Musudan missile, which has a range to hit Guam, which has 165,000 American citizens, but is obviously much different than a missile that would hit, for example, San Diego or Seattle.
And again, that, you know, those are places where, okay, if it can hit the United States, we're rarely a target of anyone's offensive actions. But that range and their ability to provide that missile to other bad actors means they could be the go-to, you know, mass destruction missile dealer of choice for pretty much any bad actor who then could have the capability to hit pretty much any of their enemies. So this is distinctly disturbing for us, but should be disturbing to pretty much anybody who lives on Earth.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, to get more specific on that, the IRBM, the Intermediate Range Ballistic Missile, the Musudan that the North Koreans have, they sold 18 of those to Iran. And Iran tested it at a range of 4,000 kilometers back in 2006, according to several press sources, which means Iran can essentially now hit Tel Aviv with their NODON, which they got from obviously the North Koreans, and they can hit NATO headquarters in Brussels with their version of the Musudan, which of course they got from the North Koreans. I do think it's important to point out that the unclassified analysis that we saw from this gentleman, Jeffrey Lewis, who is a North Korean and a missile specialist of sorts. Basically, he's basing that analysis strictly on burn marks in the ground. In other words, when I went back and looked at his analysis, there were no images or imagery, if you will, of the transporter erector launcher that was used to launch this. In other words, the transporter erector launcher, or TEL, for the KN-08 is 8-wheeled, whereas it's 6-wheeled for the Musudan launcher. So if he had seen the launcher, he would probably have referenced it. He doesn't have a picture of that. He obviously didn't see the launch. And in addition to that, both our own DOD and the ROC Ministry of National Defense have both reiterated that they assess it to be a Musudan launch. Now, that doesn't mean that it's still not possible that this was a launch, the first launch, I might add, of an ICBM. It just means that we don't have a whole lot of evidence yet. And so I would hesitate to make a call. So that's where we're standing right now on this last failed launch that the North Koreans conducted.
I take your point that if this was not an ICBM, perhaps it is not as immediately dangerous. But let's assume it was just the intermediate range missile, and combining that with the nuclear testing they've been doing, and the fact that the Iran nuclear deal has put a lot of the other states in the Gulf region on a heightened sense of danger, given the fact that they're now testing more missiles. They're looking at essentially a clear path at some point to nuclear weapons. What's the chance that the North Koreans may be selling more of those to other folks in the region as opposed to just to the Iranians?
Well, that's a very good point. I think that they may be selling these to Syria eventually. And I also think they'll be selling more of them to Iran. Iran only has 18 or had 18. They've tested at least two of them that we know of. So I think it's likely, bringing up the Iran deal, I think it's just insane that, Secretary Kerry was talking about nuclear weapons with the Iranians in complete absence of the platforms that would carry them, that is to say ballistic missiles, which we know now were going back and forth between Iran and North Korea, even as the talks were going on, the JCPOA talks, which is just, I mean, you know, guys like me and you were aghast at that. The Israelis were aghast at that. I was in Israel a couple of months after the talks were concluded, and they were quite concerned. So I think we have to believe that, for example, this missile, the Musudan, which really gives Iran a capability to hit just about anywhere in Europe, is something that the Iranians are likely involved in. They may have been at the tests. And we need to be concerned that the North Koreans could put a nuclear warhead on this missile, which I'd like to point something else out about. Not only could it kill 165,000 American citizens on Guam, but the other reason they want to target Guam is because at Anderson Air Force Base on Guam, as you know, that's where we have our strategic bombers that would take out North Korean WMD in any wartime situation. So this is a key concern for the North Koreans, and it's probably why they built a missile that had that range. And, you know, as you brought up at the beginning of this segment, I still think it's important for us to keep an eye out for the KN-08, because on the off chance that this was the initial launch of the KN-08, that means they're at the point where they're now actually, they have gone beyond just engine testing, they're launching the actual missile itself. So interesting stuff.
Obviously, they've sold to the Iranians. The Iranians are pointing out that was actually happening, that the missiles were en route while we were busy just giving away the entire farm in the Iran nuclear deal, should stun people, as every time another revelation about that deal comes out, it's never good news. So it's the, I guess, real danger then, a larger and closer tie with Iran. Do the North Koreans seem to really be fostering that relationship?
They do, and that's another excellent point. You're raising some great points this evening. They, at the time that nuclear deal was going on, were collaborating with the North Koreans, the Iranians were, on an 80-ton rocket booster for an ICBM. After the JCPOA deal was concluded, the Treasury Department sanctioned not only Iran, but they sanctioned SHIG, Iran's primary liquid fuel development corporation, and individuals in Iran who had visited North Korea. So, I mean, the United States government is not denying this. They just didn't bring the sanctions against Iran until after the talks were concluded. So what I think you can likely expect to see over coming years is Iran will likely develop upgrades to its nuclear weaponization program offshore in North Korea. I think we can very likely expect that. And you can also expect to see upgrades to these long-range and mid-range ballistic missiles going back and forth between Iran and North Korea, because this is very profitable for North Korea and they'll want to do that to continue to maintain their military development, obviously, and to help keep the elite in the style of living in which they have been for the past few years.
Bruce Bechtel, thank you so much for your continued weather eye on the dangers posed by North Korean missile development and proliferation. Up next, we're going to be talking with Bill Gertz, senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, about President Obama engaging our enemies. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
To SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Bill Gertz, senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon and Inside the Ring columnist at the Washington Times. Bill, your Inside the Ring column this week has some interesting info from the ever-bountiful John Podesta email cache about Susan Rice when she was being vetted for a position in the Obama administration back in 2008. And it seems one of the necessities and one of the selling points for her was the fact that she was open to dealing with, negotiating with, and treating with America's enemies. And I guess in the current, you know, context, and having watched this play out over two terms, obviously, that was a major thing for the Obama administration. They seem to have been more interested in working with our enemies than our friends. They seem to have kind of flipped the calculus and stab our friends in the front and slap our enemies on the back. So she seems to have been a perfect fit.
Yeah, this was a very interesting revelation that came out of the WikiLeaks Podesta emails. It goes back to 2008, actually before the Obama administration came in. They were vetting a number of officials, one of whom was Susan Rice, who during the Clinton administration had been a White House Africa Affairs official on the NSC staff and then later an assistant secretary of state. And it's very interesting to see these very detailed accounts of the background checks that are done. And this one document was done by the law firm of Covington and Burling, which was literally vetting people for senior positions, national security positions. And in the case of Susan Rice, they stated openly that she shares Obama's view that it's okay to engage America's enemies when it's in pursuit of U.S. interests.
I'm going to go ahead and make a semi-devil's advocate argument for engaging our enemies. Because, I mean, Ronald Reagan was steadfast in talking to our biggest enemy and probably the greatest threat of our lifetimes, the Soviet Union. So there's something to be said for engaging our enemies and talking with them and treating with them and doing those things. But I think the problem is the Obama administration took that to an extreme that makes absolutely no sense in the greater strategic calculus. You have to be showing your enemies that there is a price to pay for crossing you, that there is a danger to opposing U.S. national interests. And in all too many cases, it seems the Obama administration has shown our enemies that there is nothing to fear in opposing U.S. interests, that there is nothing and everything to gain in going ahead and threatening us and doing all these things, because in the end, they're not going to oppose you and they're likely to reward you.
And right. And when we go back to the Reagan administration, the underpinning of the Reagan administration was the concept of peace through strength. So if you're going to engage your enemies, you're going to do it from a position of strength. In the case of the Obama administration, it's been absolutely turned on its head. It's peace through weakness and appeasement. And that has led to the new world disorder that we're facing today. Weakness is provocative. It provokes powers to take action they normally wouldn't do. And he clearly was making America weak, appearing weak, bowing to our enemies, apologizing for America. And that's what we're stuck with now. The world's a mess, and it's based on this idea of weakness.
among the right, there has been a common theme of watching Obama literally bow to world leaders around around the globe. I mean, he shows up and bows to the Saudis, the Chinese, whoever he gets to. And I think it shows the fundamental misconception that you just outlined. If you show that you are not the strong horse, especially in the Islamic world, that is going to be exploited. And in the world of superpowers, it's okay to be polite. It's okay to treat people well and to be respectful. It's another thing to show submission. And I think, unfortunately, that's been the cornerstone of the Obama policy. Let's move to a great power that we've had a significant sliding of our level of clout with, the Chinese. Now, you've got a piece talking about them stealing state secrets. That's obviously been something they've been involved with for a long time, but this seems to be particularly heinous and related to DOD information. Tell us what you found.
Yeah, this was a real eye-opener to me again. It's a story that I wrote that's based on a forthcoming Congressional China Commission report. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission does an annual report, and as part of their transparency laws, they release the draft of the report, and it's coming out in about 2 weeks, and so this was a late draft, and it included for the first time in a long time an entire chapter on Chinese intelligence operations. And what it showed was that the Chinese have just done extraordinary both cyber and human intelligence attacks across the board on our defense systems, to the point where they have stolen Pentagon war plans for China. It was a little noticed case from back in 2014. A retired lieutenant colonel, Air Force, at the Pacific Command was seduced by a woman Chinese spy into providing secret intelligence and information, including the war plans, as well as the DOD strategy for China.
Well, you actually have another piece highlighting another instance where Chinese aggression in the waters in the South China Sea and other places has gone uncontested. They've been very belligerent in building new islands to claim larger swaths of that maritime area. And we have been somewhat remiss and in many cases absent from our usual role in freedom of navigation exercises. When other folks start claiming more of, you know, the water than they actually legitimately can, the U.S. has consistently been the force to go ahead and say, well, no, you can't do that. You know, we're going to drive a couple aircraft carriers or something through that area and point out to you that you don't own it and you can't do that. And it seems the Obama administration has been deficient in doing that as among the other weaknesses they've shown.
Yes, this is another internal revelation from the Podesta emails, which sheds light on one of the most dangerous strategic flashpoints right now, and that's the South China Sea, where China has been reclaiming and rebuilding islands to the tune of 3,200 acres. This has been going on for the last 5 years, and only in the past few years has there been any pushback whatsoever. It turns out that a little noticed advisory panel known as the Defense Policy Board, it's part of the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy Office, and they basically blew the whistle and issued a report. It came out because one of the board members was secretly collaborating with the Hillary Clinton presidential campaign in disclosing these internal discussions. This board member's name is Stuart Eisenstadt, who's a Washington lawyer. He's on the board, and he revealed that the highest levels of the White House have prevented the Navy from conducting these really important freedom of navigation operations in the South China Sea. These are naval warship passages that go within 12 miles of these disputed islands. And for a period between 2011 and 2015, there were none. And it was because the White House regarded them as too provocative, once again, sucking up to America's enemies, in this case, China. And so the Defense Policy Board said, look, we got to start these things right away. And that worked. Within 1 month of this September 2015 report, the Navy began its first operation. They did another one in January, And then again, it was blocked by the White House. And then they recently did one last week.
Well, Bill, thank you so much for being one of the folks who shines a light on these weaknesses and the danger they prove to our security and the security of the world as a whole. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank will be back next week to keep you informed in the war for the free world. This is Jim Hansen, and we're out.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.